Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Hello from sunny, happy London. Everybody's happy here except the one Cockney cab driver who, in the run-up to the Wimbledon final, said, well, he's not rooting for Andy Murray because Andy Murray 10 years ago said something nasty about the English. He's a Scotsman, you know. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, on this weekend when we're celebrating the anniversary of the birth of the nation that still apparently has a Fourth Amendment as well as a First and a Second. I mean, the Second Amendment has a built-in support constituency, guys with guns, and the First Amendment does the establishment press, unless it's somebody who's not in the establishment press whose free speech rights are violated. But there doesn't appear to be a big support constituency for the Fourth Amendment. So, hence all the issues we're having with the two C's, secrecy and privacy.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing.
Thank you. Vice President Joe Biden there, ladies and gentlemen, setting the table for this discussion. It's not really a discussion. I'm yakking at you. But first of all, the New York Times has caught up with, or is trying to, playing catch up with the Washington Post and the Guardian on the whole issue of secrecy and privacy, the two C's. In today's editions, it has a front page story about our secret court. Doesn't that make you proud to know we have one of those? I think the founders would be real, maybe might be rushing to scratch their signatures off the Declaration if they knew that, a couple of centuries later, we'd have a secret court issuing secret opinions, a secret parallel to the Supreme Court, according to the New York Times story, because this secret court, the FISA court, so-called, well, it is called that, has been issuing not just individual opinions on individual requests for warrants secretly, but opinions that basically are interpreting the Constitution in sessions, as has been pointed out on this broadcast before, where only the government lawyers appear. It is not an adversary proceeding. There is no representation for whatever other side there might be. Why would there be a side other than the government? And the opinions, of course, are secret. And the people who see the opinions are secret. Or soon will be. And yet, very often the other media follow the lead of the New York Times, at least the New York-based media. But on the Sunday Yak shows that I was able to see today, stuff about the plane crash in San Francisco, understandably. Stuff about Egypt, which nobody understands. And nothing about this. Nothing about how we must be busting our buttons to have a secret court. One person who did have his privacy violated this week, apparently, is the head of Nice Corp. Rupert Murdoch. Nice people doing nice things. Scotland Yard detectives are attempting to track down a secret recording of Rupert Murdoch admitting to journalists on his tabloid newspaper, The Sun, that payments to public officials, particularly cops, were part of the, quote, culture of Fleet Street, unquote. Fleet Street has a culture. That's right. Newspaper reporters singing Carmen. A police officer connected to the investigation into illicit payments from journalists has made a formal request to the website that broke the story to hand over the undercover tape of Murdoch talking to the journalists in March. I did what any good citizen would do and went to that website and downloaded the tape. And I spent a little while, ladies and gentlemen, trying to clean it up for you. I don't mean language-wise, just so you could understand it. But I love you. I love this audience. But I'm not going to spend my whole weekend doing that. So it's not really, I could play it and you'd go, what? Why is he wasting that time? So I'm wasting the time instead telling you this. The police are seeking a production or a compelling Exaro News, this investigative website, to disclose the recording if it did not do so voluntarily. Police in London are ready to examine Murdoch's private disclosures because they're so nice. Now, since the tapes emerged, Murdoch is recorded saying the culture of paying police officers for stories existed at every newspaper in Fleet Street long since forgotten, but absolutely. Fleet Street, where London newspapers used to be headquartered until Rupert busted the unions and moved by moving to a secretly overnight to a new location. The editor-in-chief of Exaro News says he hasn't handed any material to Scotland Yard. He says, we're making public everything we have, and I cannot see how else we can help. They just need to keep logging into our site, he says. Well, he just wants clicks. As does Rupert. Nice people doing nice things at Nice Corp. But he did say that he would support the folks at the tabloid newspaper during the trials, and I can't promise, but I can promise support after as well. More on secrecy. Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian, who has been the conduit for most of the material from ex-NSA contractor, not employee, contractor, Edward Snowden, has written a story for the front page of the Sunday edition of a large Brazilian newspaper, O Globo. U.S. spied on millions of emails and calls of Brazilians. Because you know how many Brazilian terrorists there have been recently, don't you? The NSA for years has systematically tapped into the Brazilian telecommunications network and indiscriminately intercepted, collected, and stored the email and telephone records of millions of Brazilians. Or is it Brazilians of Brazilians? This story follows an article in Der Spiegel last week detailing the NSA's mass and indiscriminate collection of the electronic communications of millions of Germans. There are many, says Greenwald, there are many more populations of non-adversarial countries which have been subjected to the same type of mass surveillance net by the NSA. The list of those which haven't is shorter than those which have. All this bulk surveillance aimed at populations of friendly foreign nations is part of the NSA's Fairview program. Oops, I wasn't supposed to mention. Under that program, the NSA partners with a large U.S. telecommunications company, the identity of which is currently unknown, and that company then partners with telecoms in the foreign countries. This part of the story has been covered, I think, in the Washington Post today as well, how NASA gets access to the undersea cables. These partnerships allow the U.S. company access to those countries' telecommunication systems, and that access is then exploited to direct traffic to the NSA. Both these articles were based on top-secret documents provided by Snowden. The privacy rights of Americans are not the only ones being violated by the NSA. The U.S. government, in complete secrecy, says Greenwald is constructing a ubiquitous spying apparatus aimed not only at its own citizens, but at all of the world's citizens. So y'all come to the No Privacy Party. But it's not just the federal government. When the city of San Leandro, California, purchased a license plate reader for its police department in 2008, a computer security consultant asked the city for a record of every time the scanners photographed his car. Turns out, his two cars have been photographed on 112 occasions, including one image from 2009 that shows him and his daughter stepping out of his Prius in their driveway. That made him frightened and concerned about the magnitude of police surveillance and data collection. The single patrol car in San Leandro, California, south of San Francisco, east of San Francisco, equipped with a license plate reader, had logged his car once a week on average, photographing his plate and documenting the time of location. Time and location. At a rapid pace and mostly hidden from the public, police agencies throughout California have been collecting millions of records on drivers, feeding them to intelligence fusion centers operated by state, local, and federal law enforcement. The localized effort to track drivers highlights the extent to which the government has committed to collecting large amounts of data on people who have done nothing wrong. A year ago, the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, one of dozens, set up after 9/11, signed a $340,000 agreement with a Silicon Valley firm to construct a database of license plate records flowing in from police using the devices across 14 counties. The extent of the center's data collection has not previously been revealed, nor has the involvement of Palantir, a Silicon Valley firm with extensive ties to the Pentagon and intelligence agencies. The CIA's venture capital fund, did you know about this, InQtel, follow them on the NASDAQ, has invested $2 million in the firm. Law enforcement agencies throughout Northern California will be able to access the data, as will state and federal authorities. So, maybe it's time for those counterfeit license plates. Maybe it's time to just repeal the Fourth Amendment altogether. What do you think? Anyway, it's the 4th of July weekend, and we're saluting the flag. Hello, welcome to the show.
Now I was raised a decent way to swell my heart with pride. Each and every time I saw glory passing by. Raised to think that America was the land you love to love. That the stars stood for heaven, the stripes stood for faith, and that old flag's what God meant man to fly. But somewhere, from a spaceship maybe, comes another breed. Yeah, these folks are so nutty that it's crazy glue they bleed. And they burn the beloved symbol of our nation's liberty. But the stars still stand for heaven, the stripes still stand for faith, and a killing's what those people really need. So let the flag burners fry on the 4th of July. We'll declare them independent of their skins. We'll bake us up some taters and we'll roast some desecrators. Let them fry on the 4th of July. 4th of July. Now a flag is just a little more than fabric and some thread. Its blue came from the heavens, from the blood of patriots came the red. And the white? The white came from the only race that's voted since the start. But the stars still stand for heaven, the stripes still stand for faith. You put those dreams of burning it to bed. Now, some people talk of freedom, but let me tell you, friends, your freedom doesn't start until the time when my nose ends. And a lot of people die so I could sing this little song. But the stars still stand for heaven, the stripes still stand for faith. The flag that's burnt ashes never mends. So let the flag burners fry on the 4th of July. We'll make them part of the fireworks display. We'll shoot off Roman candles and electrocute the vandals. Let them fry on the 4th of July. One more time, everybody. Oh, let the flag burners fry on the 4th of July. You know Miss Betsy Ross would have wanted it this way. If they don't like it here, they can leave it all behind. Let them fry on the 4th of July. 4th of July. July.
From London, England, home of the Wimbledon champion, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, it's not just governments that are attacking your privacy. To prove the point, let me read the trades for you. AOL enables brands to track users' unconscious emotions in real time. I'll read it for you. I already have. You've forgotten it. I know that because I'm tracking your unconscious. In a move that ups the, this is from Online Media Daily, in a move that ups the ante for real-time media measurement, AOL has unveiled a new platform that enables brands to measure not just whether people are exposed to or even see their advertising, but how they actually feel about it. The platform, which is being introduced by AOL's branded entertainment unit, BeOn, utilizes users' own webcams to read their facial expressions while watching a brand's video content in order to understand what their unconscious feelings are while exposed to the brand's messages. Are you okay with this, Ariana?
I love it.
The platform is being powered by Realize, R-E-A-L-E-Y-E-S, a tech firm that has figured out an economical way of utilizing computer vision to read faces and measure human emotion via webcams on users' PCs, tablets, and smartphones. And initially will only track the faces and emotions of users participating into opt-in consumer panels. But Beyond CEO Rene Rechtman says AOL is already considering ways it could deploy the technology to track the emotional sentiment of its general users who want to opt into it. Or the initial goal, he says, is to improve engagement levels that users have with brands running video content on AOL. But over time, he says, it could be used to improve the overall user experience with any AOL or user content. It's always been very clear that content that has a strong emotional component has a much greater engagement and consumer response, says Rechtman. We always knew that, but we didn't have the science to execute it. Now we have the technology to measure how content affects people emotionally. AOL's program is the latest in a rapid progression of so-called neuromarketing research applications that have emerged over the past half dozen years. New forms of biometric measurement technologies have enabled neuroscientists to develop methods for measuring the unconscious responses that consumers have to media, advertising, and other forms of marketing. Even what people are feeling when they're in stores looking at products and offers on shelves. Such neuromarketing initiatives have been a major focus on Madison Avenue, including the Advertising Research Foundation, ARF, SIT, which gave ample discussion to it during last week's audience measurement conference in New York. But coincidental developments in technology, especially the ubiquitous distribution of webcams, have created the opportunity to scale such tracking and to do it in real time. Recently, Sticky, a company that Procter & Gamble encouraged to develop a method for using webcams to track users' eye movements to verify whether consumers are actually looking at ads, introduced a panel capable of measuring it among hundreds of thousands of users in real time. Are you watching our cheer video? Are you watching our cheer video? As significant as eye tracking is, AOL's Rechtman says emotional tracking is the next logical progression because the goal of media content, especially the kind of native brand content AOL's unit is developing, is to influence the eyes that are on it. From Marketing Daily, a rundown of some of the tools that are available in this kind of neat stuff. Biometrics, stable and sensitive measure of emotional engagement, provides great specificity and overall effect. Consumer friendly, scalable. Facial coding, passive measurement for type of emotional response and emotional valence. Secondary indicator of emotional engagement. Easy to integrate into surveys. EEG, highly sensitive measure of engagement and emotional valence. Provides great specificity, less consumer-friendly, and scalable, depending upon equipment used. They might want to borrow some from the Scientologist. Eye tracking, attention and interest, patterns of observation, what is seen in what order and for how long, with great specificity, consumer-friendly and scalable. Now available online, in-store, etc. fMRI, most sensitive neuro tool. The MRI, of course, is for magnetic resonance imagery. Most sensitive neuro tool relied upon in academic labs for exploratory research on emotional response, engagement, and memory. Most expensive, least scalable. Implicit, understanding unconscious perceptions and impact of stimuli on brands, sensitive for differentiating between brands and ads on key attributes and drivers. Easy to include in surveys, consumer-friendly. Are you listening? I know you are. might wonder how. Why bother fearing NSA when you can fear Procter & Gamble and Sticky? Question that occurs when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. Pope Francis will make his first international trip to the world's largest Catholic country later this month for World Youth Day. It's always world. It seems to be always World Youth Day, doesn't it? I don't know. It seems to come around a lot. That's just me. A shortage in the expected millions of pilgrims whose contributions are part funding the cost has led the Vatican to identifying a black hole of up to $65 million in paying for the Pope's visit, according to Brazilian media. Brazil's federal, state, and city officials in Rio, who've already committed $80 million of public money to the $149 million Pope visit, are said to have refused the Vatican's request to contribute any more. Recent mass protests across Brazil, in which more than a million people demonstrated against the lack of investment in public services compared with the Pope's visit, the World Cup, and the Olympics, may have played a part in the decision. The plan originally was for pilgrims who had been expected to number up to 2 million to fund about two-thirds of the costs with their registration fees. But so far, only 320,000 pilgrims have registered. Government officials indicating they now may only be expecting less than half of the initial estimate, if that. According to government sources, Vatican officials met with the Rio mayor, the state governor, and the president's chief of staff and requested that each provide an extra $13 million in funding. Brazil's government is already committed, as we said, to spend a lot on the event, mainly for security. The security operation is said to be unprecedented for a visiting dignitary in Brazil. The state is also committed to spending at least $11 million on free transportation for the pilgrims to go look at the Pope. Files released by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee revealed that in 2007, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, then the archbishop there, requested permission from the Vatican to move nearly $57 million into a cemetery trust fund to protect the assets from victims of clergy sexual abuse who were demanding compensation. Cardinal Dolan is now the Archbishop of New York. He's emphatically denied seeking to shield church funds. He reiterated in a statement this week that these were old and discredited attacks. The files, however, contain a 2007 letter to the Vatican from the then Archbishop of Milwaukee, in which he explains that by transferring the assets, quote, I foresee an improved protection of these funds from any legal claim and liability, unquote. It took the Vatican all of 5 weeks to approve the old switcheroo. Clergy sex abuse victims have long accused that archdiocese in Milwaukee of spending more money on lawyers to protect itself than to care for those who suffered at the hands of abusive priests. An AP analysis of documents released this week found that most of the $30 million the archdiocese paid out through middle of last year went to victim settlements and therapy, but the bulk of it went to just a few victims. Hundreds of others got no money at all. The records support victims' longtime claim that Wisconsin for many years was among the more difficult states for them to get compensation. The main reason was a Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling in 1995 that made it nearly impossible to hold the church responsible for its priests' actions. The court said the church was protected from negligence lawsuits by the First Amendment. No longer afraid of litigation, the archdiocese then established a no-settlement policy that lasted until the national clergy abuse scandal erupted in 2002. It's impossible to say for certain how much money sex abuse victims of the clergy have received from the Milwaukee Archdiocese, according to the AP, because accounting before 2003 is, according to the AP, quote, questionable. Victims question the Archdiocese totals. They can't come up with their own because the Archdiocese accounts and most settlement records, sound familiar, are not public. The Australian Catholic Church had extensive knowledge dating back to the 1950s of the sexual abuse of children by the pedophile priest Dennis McAlinden, which continued over four decades on children as young as four and five. An inquiry into the whole mess has heard. One boy who was abused by McAlinden between the ages of five and nine was required to do penance after he told his parish priests, apparently for his sin in being abused, the inquiry was told. That child has died since then. And plans to move that known pedophilic Catholic priest from Hunter Valley region to work in Western Australia were, quote, a good cover-up, a special commission of inquiry has been told. The counsel assisting the commission, Julia Lonergan, says the idea of a cover-up about McAlinden was put forward in a letter from a senior Hunter Valley Catholic priest, Monsignor Patrick Cotter, to the then bishop. Church officials had extensive knowledge of the serious risk McAlinden posed to children dating back to the 1950s. Allegations surfaced in 1975 that he had abused a primary school girl in the Hunter Valley. He might have been the hunter in the Hunter Valley. In 1976, several children had made statements to a solicitor they'd been sexually abused by McAlinden, and these were given to church leaders. The Monsignor's letter said in part, quote, the reason why the father wants to go so very much now to Western Australia is because it will afford a good cover-up for his resigning the parish, his words. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Little palate cleanser. Another wave of answers to questions that begin with so, even though they're not concluding anything. First up this week, I believe one of two entries from our friends at the BBC.
When the sun releases a flare, it can also emit a strong burst of radio waves that interfere with the GPS signals, as Catherine Mitchell, Professor of Electrical Engineering at the University of Bath, describes.
So effectively what the sun's doing, it's acting like a big jammer.
So say I was driving in my car, what would I experience?
So if there was a really big solar radio burst, then what would happen is it would be a bit like when you drive into a tunnel.
What other areas of society would notice the effect?
So a really, really important area would be for aircraft navigation. So for aircraft navigation, it's much, much more important if you lose a system than it is, for example, if you're driving along in the car.
So you say. Now, our second entry from the Beeb.
Jim Byrne is chief executive of Live Theatre, a theatre company based here in Newcastle. What have what has been the magnitude of the cuts so far?
So in Newcastle, about 600,000 has been cut off the original 1.2 million budget.
And what else are you doing? What other novel ways? We talked about those. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So there's about 10 major cultural institutions in Newcastle and Gateshead.
I find that hard to believe. And from the... Is it NPR? NPR, the Diane Rehm Show.
So what are they challenging the report now, Coral?
So, the EPA objected to the draft report when it came out a number of weeks ago.
Okay, so...
Yeah, so let's continue that conversation. And it just went on like that. So, there you go. Now, ladies and gentlemen, follow the money. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman this week accuses Verizon of trying to depart from a century of telephone service regulation by ending wired telephone service in a part of Fire Island devastated by Hurricane Sandy last year. Isn't that nice? Oh, we can't restore the copper wires. We'll just replace that with wireless service. And please don't regulate it like you used to regulate the landline service. Verizon is telling customers outside of Fire Island they should accept wireless phone service as well instead of repairs to their landline service. Schneiderman is asking that Verizon be fined $100,000 per customer per day. Verizon is trying to gain state approval to end wireline service, landline service, entirely in Western Fire Island. Says Ars Technica, a technical website. It's no secret the telephone companies want to abandon the traditional telephone network and switch to wireless. AT&T has asked the FCC to lead this transition and get rid of the conventional public utility style regulation associated with landline phone service. That has, among other things, required universal phone service so everybody could have it. Verizon proposes amending state regulations in New York to allow wireless-only service when facilities are destroyed or when it's simply deemed unreasonable because of geographic location or availability of competing services. Only some folks in Fire Island have so far raised the question, which I like to raise when such ideas are presented. Next time a disaster comes, usually it follows the usual pattern. First thing that goes is the electric grid, and so the second thing that goes are the cell towers. What you going to do then, Verizon? And the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency has once again missed its desired target. Missed its desired target during flight testing of an interceptor missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base northwest of Santa Barbara. The failure of the $214 million test involved a system designed by Boeing. We know why we're here, to charge you $214 million for something that doesn't work. The Missile Defense Agency has a 500 batting average right now. The last successful one was 4.5 years ago. The testing was halted in early 2011 after errors resulted in two failed intercept tests in 2010. The technology wasn't used this week, but will be tested again next year. During the test, a target missile was fired. 5 minutes later, a three-stage interceptor was launched from Vandenberg. After blast off, the booster is designed to deploy a kill vehicle, banned by Raytheon, to hit the target at a designated point in space. The Missile Defense Agency did not yet know the cause of test failure. Despite the poor track record for this ground-based system of 30 interceptors in Alaska and California, which the GAO estimates would cost taxpayers $40 billion, through 2017. Despite the poor track record, the Pentagon plans to add 14 missile interceptors in Alaska to counter the threat from, any guesses? North Korea. The best defense is a bigger defense budget. And ladies and gentlemen, as I said at the top of the show, we're celebrating the flag, but you know, this country's got more than one. Still.
Southland, land of cotton and loam. Losers got to have a place to call home. Secession, well, it's the source of our pride, 'cause our kinfolk were on the losing side. Yeah, our kinfolk were on the losing side. Oh, the stars and bars will never be forgot. On our state flag, the X marks the spot. It took bravery to fight for slavery. That's how we're inclined, 'cause we're just the losing kind. Always left behind, 'cause we're just the losing kind. Jackson, it's Anglo-Saxon no more. Macon, you be shaking when you go to the store. Throughout our states, there is this deep divide, 'cause our kinfolk were on the losing side. Yeah, our kinfolk were on the losing side. Oh, the stars and bars will never be forgot. We're Johnny Reb and not some Hottentot. It took bravery for slavery. You can't be colorblind when you're with the loser. don't watch, we rewind. 'Cause we're just the losing kind. Surrenders what we sign. 'Cause we're just the losing kind.
From London, this is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? Award-winning, once upon a time.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
The Arctic could prove to be a climate time bomb, according to early results from a NASA experiment to monitor the release of greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost. With previous data on CO2 and methane released from the carbon-rich soils imprecise, the Carbon in Arctic Reservoirs Vulnerability Experiment, CARV, has been able to fill in the blanks with initial indications creating cause for concern. While it was known that the release of gases that had previously been trapped in solid ground were now able to escape in larger volumes, CARV is allowing scientists to estimate the extent of the problem with more accuracy. Quote, "We're definitely looking at a sleeping climate giant. From a scientific perspective, the thing I find the most amazing about this is potential for large-scale carbon release in the high latitudes," says Charles Miller, principal investigator of CARV. Continuing to quote, "We have so little information that is quantitative and long-term, and we have so much uncertainty, it's extremely difficult to predict what is going to happen with any degree of certainty," he says. The scale of the problem is huge. Estimated by 2040, 19 to 45 gigatons of CO2 will be released by the thawing permafrost. Human activity since the Industrial Revolution has emitted 350 gigatons. But wait, there's more. According to the Financial Times, insurers have issued a rare warning that the speed at which the oceans are warming is threatening their ability to sell affordable policies in a growing number of places around the world. Parts of the United Kingdom and the U.S. state of Florida were already facing, quote, "a risk environment that is uninsurable," unquote, according to the global insurance industry trade body, the Geneva Association. "They're unlikely to be the last areas with such problems," says John Fitzpatrick, the association's secretary general. He says governments needed to invest more in flood defenses and tighten building restrictions in risky locations to mitigate the fallout from extreme weather hazards. He cites the losses from Sandy. But at least they're not going to put back the copper wires for the phones. "In the long run, governments are going to have big exposures to repair damaged infrastructures from storms," he says. In spite of the losses from Sandy and spate of natural catastrophes the previous year, overall global property insurance premiums have remained broadly stable. Outside the loss-hit areas, however, insurers warn premiums have been kept artificially depressed in the short term, because capital has flocked to the insurance sector in the face of historic low interest rates everywhere else. Scientists have reported signs of warming oceans for more than a decade, but more recent studies cited in a Geneva Association report this week suggest this may be more pronounced than previously thought. Pronounced. More national temperature records were broken in the last decade than in previous ones. According to the BBC, the Earth experienced unprecedented recorded climate extremes during the decade 2001-2010, quoting a report from the World Meteorological Organization. What do they know? Its new report says more national temperature records were reported broken than in previous decades, and there was an increase in deaths from heat waves over that decade, particularly during the extreme summers in Europe in 2003 and in Russia during 2010. Despite the decade being the second wettest since 1901, 2010 being the wettest year recorded, fewer people died from floods than in the previous decade because of better warning systems and increased preparedness. Last year, the United States experienced its warmest year ever, says the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Globally, 2012 was the ninth warmest year since 1850, with the years from 2001 to 2012 being among the top 13 warmest on record, the hottest 2010. A study from the United Kingdom provides more fodder. According to the University of Sheffield, jet stream changes are blamed for the big ice melt in Greenland and may signal another big year of heat and melting. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, news of the F-bomb. The new F-bomb, foreclosure. Almost all the checks have gone out from the settlement the government regulators initially touted as their most aggressive effort to root out banks' errors, hold them accountable, and right the wrongs done to many wrongdoers, to many homeowners. The outcome falls short of the vindication many borrowers expected. Nearly $3.4 billion has been paid out to 3.9 million borrowers since mid-April. An additional 300,000 or so borrowers will get their payments in the coming weeks. It's outrageous, says one advocate. People were clearly expecting more than $300. The payouts, far from closing the books on an economic catastrophe, have instead reignited old feelings of anger and frustration. Almost two-thirds of the recipients received $300. Fewer than 1,200 got $125,000 each, the most allowed. The rest fell into one of 10 other categories for compensation, mostly in the range between $400 and $7,500. You're welcome. And Bank of America employees regularly lied to homeowners seeking loan modifications, denied their applications for made-up reasons, and were rewarded for sending homeowners to foreclosure, according to sworn statements by former bank employees seen by the ProPublica news site. The employee statements were filed in federal court in Boston as part of a multi-state class action suit brought on behalf of homeowners who sought to avoid foreclosure through the government's HAMP program, but say that they had their cases botched or hampered by Bank of America. The bank says each of the former employee statements is rife with factual inaccuracies. Six of the former employees worked for the bank. One worked for a contractor. You heard earlier this year Eve Smith from NakedCapitalism.com quoting from her reporting of insiders who had worked on the review, the botched review that was supposed to lead to that settlement that was foreshortened when it was botched. And the insiders all reported somewhat similar kinds of proceedings. But they're, you know, they're the banks. So far, the accountability is in stuff like this being put on shows like this. But that's enough accountability, isn't it? Now, ladies and gentlemen, on this 4th of July weekend, looking back longingly, to that time, not so long ago, right after 9/11, and for a long time afterwards. I mean, it's hard maybe now to remember, but in the 2008 election campaign, one of the issues was at least raised by the opposition. How come Barack Obama isn't wearing his flag pin? So as I say, harking back to that time, much like now, when showing the flag was the litmus test for whether you were a patriot or really belonged in the country. Here's Dewey Gordon.
Oh, your shelves, they start with goodies. But being in your star is such a drag. 'Cause the red, white, and blue is nowhere in view. Hey, where's your flag? Yeah, your hotel, oh, so very charming. And you know, I really hate to nag, but there's gonna be hissing. Old Glory is missing. Hey, where's your flag? Where's your flag? It doesn't sit in your window. It doesn't fly from your roof. Where's your flag? You say you country, but how about some proof? Oh, it could be a banner or poster. It could be a pin, a decal, or a coaster.
for my back tires or adjuster? Where's your flag? Where's your flag? You know, we got to keep the good times moving. We can't let the economy sag. But before my credit card gets swiped, I gotta get stars and stripes. Hey, where's your flag? Those new cars, they look great in your showroom. Can't even look at the tag. Francis Scott Key, yeah, he said it for me. Hey, where's your flag? Where's your flag? It doesn't sit in your window. It doesn't fly. Oh, where's your flag? You say you love your country. Well, how about some proof? It could be a banner, a poster, a pin, a decal, or a coaster. But before I buy fryers or a roaster, where's your flag? Where's your flag? Where's your flag? Where's your flag?
And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
News of the inspectors general. After major communications problems during the flooding of New Orleans, the National Guard Bureau fielded 97 joint incident site communications capability systems to ensure better communications among federal, state, and local rescue workers. The goal? To ensure communications among the different communications systems used by first responders. But a new report from the Defense Department's IG says major problems remain, compromising response time by the National Guard, which is the first responders of the military. National Guard units now have access to high-frequency radio, telephone, video, and satellite equipment. It's not always available, maintained, staffed, or ready for use during a domestic emergency. According to the IG's report, training is also a serious problem. The report said that Louisiana National Guard has two trained members on advanced communications equipment, but needs four more. Similar shortfalls are rampant across all 50 state National Guard units, according to the IG's report. These conditions occurred because National Guard Bureau officials did not have adequate oversight procedures in place to monitor sustainment, really, of the systems provided National Guard units. As a result, DOD, the Defense Department, may experience reduced communications when coordinating with federal, state, and local first responders during future emergencies, which may adversely affect rescue and relief efforts and increase the risk of physical and economic damages and human casualties, unquote. The Inspector General. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction has received information suggesting there is a serious problem related to disputes regarding the payment of Afghan subcontractors by prime contractors. Evidence from credible sources alleges death threats, work stoppages, and strikes in connection with allegations of non-payment of subcontractors, as well as allegations of questionable intervention by the Afghan Attorney General's office. A 2011 reinvestigation of Edward Snowden's background check may have been faulty. The Office of Personnel Management Inspector General Patrick McFarland told Congress. The Pentagon's purchasing agency says Boeing must refund $13.7 million in excessive prices charged on spare parts, including a $10 device for which the defense contractor charged $2,286 apiece. That's from the Defense Logistics Agency. And Boeing, you know what their ad campaign is? We know why we're here. Yeah, yes, you do. News from the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen, segueing quickly into the apologies of the week. An Irish banker taped saying he would demand cash from authorities to keep operating and making light of a 2008 bailout prompted criticism all around Europe. Now he's apologized for his comments in an interview published last week. Public outrage grew after the Irish Independent published taped telephone conversations between executives of the now defunct Anglo-Irish Bank, wrecked in 2008 when the property bubble burst after years of reckless lending. David Drum, then chief executive, had said he would demand moolah from the central bank in tapes of conversations that mocked a bank guarantee that pushed Ireland into years of austerity. The most senior U.S. intelligence official told a Senate oversight panel he simply didn't think of the Patriot Act when he testified in March that the NSA did not wittingly snoop on communications of citizens. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, the D9, apologized for giving clearly erroneous testimony at the March hearing. I simply didn't think of the Patriot Act, he said. Legionella bacteria in the water at the Veterans Administration Pittsburgh Healthcare System hospitals may have sickened 10 veterans in the 4 years before a deadly outbreak of the disease blamed for 5 deaths and at least 16 others sickened last year. To anyone who was impacted by this tragedy, we are truly sorry, says the VA Pittsburgh CEO Terry Garrick Wolf. Even though the Catholic Church had extensive knowledge dating back to the 1950s of the serious risk posed to children by the pedophile priest in Australia, Dennis McAlinden, as you know, he continued sexually abusing children for decades. The bishop of the church's Newcastle diocese, Bill Wright, made a dramatic, unreserved apology from the witness box of the inquiry to victims and their families. His apology is believed to be the most comprehensive acknowledgement of child sex abuse in the Catholic Church yet made by a serving church leader. Retired FBI agent John Morris made an emotional apology in court to the families of those named by prosecutors as victims of accused mob boss James Whitey Bulger, saying he indirectly tipped off Bulger's gang that one of the victims was cooperating with federal authorities. I don't want to ask you for your forgiveness, but I do want to express my sincere apology for things that I may have done and things that I didn't do, Morris said. A dissident-turned-former president of South Korea was posthumously acquitted in a retrial 36 years after he was imprisoned for campaigning against the military-backed regime led by then-President Park Chung-hee. The Seoul High Court found the late President Kim Dae-jung not guilty of violating a now-defunct emergency decree and apologized to Kim's bereaved family for the disgraceful decision by the state, giving rise to the Billy Joel song Only the Kim Dae-jung. Deadline Vancouver, British Columbia, responding to a public backlash at downtown Eastside Strip Club has apologized and quickly removed a sign outside the bar that referred to women as, quote, fresh meat. In an emotional letter on Monday announcing his retirement after more than 60 years at Yeshiva University, its chancellor, Norman Lamb, apologized for not responding more assertively when students at the Yeshiva University High School for Boys said that two rabbis there had sexually abused them. And British Prime Minister David Cameron has apologized to Kazakh artist Karipek Kuyukov, who was born without arms, for the actions of British border services, which refused to issue him a visa because he didn't provide fingerprints. He has no arms, you see. You see what I'm saying? And I think an annual event now, the July 4th apology. This year from Wake Forest, North Carolina, an event organizer for Wake Forest's 4th of July fireworks show apologized for the shortened display, which lasted about 11 minutes. Organizers had planned for the fireworks to last half an hour. In its first year, this is now its 40th, the Wake Forest fireworks show, the show lasted only 5 minutes because the fireworks had been damaged by rain. And contestant Chrissy Biasiello on the TV series MasterChef was found to have used a racial slur in a tweet and made a joke about being raped. She's apologized I'm very sorry for any offensive posts I've made on social media, Biasiello posted on our MasterChef Twitter feed. It was never my intention to hurt or offend anybody, and I deeply apologize. According to the news report, Biasiello has been a formidable contestant on the show. She has not minced words on the broadcast. Minced words are really tasty with a nice bechamel sauce. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show.
I think Harry might have gone over the line here.
Well, thanks, Senator John McCain. We've missed you on Sundays. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world, via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast from iTunes, Sideshow Networks, and kcrw.com. And soon to be back on the air in Los Angeles. And it'd be just like being back on the air in Los Angeles if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much, A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam, Bodders, here at that crazy thing called Global Radio, for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, and a playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store at harryshearer.com for you and only you. And I'm still on Twitter, tweeting away at the Harry Shearer. Happy July 4th Amendment, everybody. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network.